far better travelled, more learned and gastronomically discerning adventurer than me, the late Anthony Bourdain, once said that any reasonable sentient person who looks at Spain, comes to Spain, eats in Spain, drinks in Spain, is going to fall in love. As he then went on,
otherwise, there's something deeply wrong with you. Spain's the sort of place that never really made any sense anyway, and in the very best possible way.
From a wine lover's point of view, that certainly rings true. With over 400 grape varieties, it is a diverse and baffling land, and one that every summer we have the privilege of exploring on the Vuelta a España. This year, our daily coverage of the race starting in Barcelona on August the 26th and ending in Madrid on September the 17th goes by the name El Clásico, a nod to another time-honoured Spanish sporting fixture. And, as every year, we've put together a case of six wines from on or close to the route with our friends from Divine Cellars of London. In this episode, and please switch off here if you come to the Cycling Podcast for cycling, cycling only, and have no interest in knowing your Riojas from your Riberas, you'll hear me discussing and tasting the selection with Angus McNabb, Divine's resident Spanish wine aficionado and guru. We were in the rather echoey Divine underground tasting bunker, pouring, clinking and slurping, and you'll hear a bit of that in my audio in particular, but hopefully it won't detract too much from your listening pleasure. The case itself is available in the UK from Divine Cellars at www.divinecellars.com, that's the letter D, vinecellars.com, and you'll find the names of the wines and information on how to order in the show notes. Just finally, and Angus and I do also touch on this in the episode, we would urge you to always consume alcohol in moderation.
Well, Angus, here we are again, a year on from our last weather case. No, Greg, this time Greg's in a canoe.
He told us this morning. He's in Australia, he's back to the homeland. He spent most of the summer, I think, watching cricket.
Yeah.
Gather. Mutual acquaintances have told me he's been really excited at the Oval, chugging rosé, I think I heard. But Angus, how are you?
I'm really good, thank you very much. Really, really good. Really excited about this case and La Vuelta in general. It looks like great route.
And Angus, you've been hard at work this summer curating the case, but you've been hard at work also travelling around the world, globetrotting, tasting lots of wine, tasting 400 wines in a week, you told me. Don't know whether that was a record. Tell us what you've been doing this summer.
So we all started in Barcelona Wine Week in February, where I went to seek some good wines, particularly for this case. And then I've been to Crete, mainland Greece, Canary Islands, Tenerife, and then a week in Washington 4 weeks ago, which was sensational. Yeah, really good wines, amazing landscape, great place for skiing, water sports, really nice people, very low-key, very different to California. It's an awesome place to go. I couldn't recommend that enough.
Crete, Greek wine, bit of a revelation for me because my parents gifted me a case from Divine Cellars for my birthday, also curated by you, and there was a Greek wine in there. Now, I've not tasted much Greek wine before, but was very impressed. And you were the man who put the case together, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, Crete is a very special place. I mean, if you know a little bit about history, you probably know a little bit about the Minos, you know, 5,000 years ago, the first civilization, and a beautiful Knos Palace. The best museum I've ever been in my life, archaeologically, is in Heraklion. And in terms of grapes, they have their own grapes. You know, it's a place that's kind of sort of in the middle of nowhere, and it's been very well protected. So the grapes that you find in Crete are very unique to the island. Fair to say, the whites are a little bit more interesting and fresher, more to the palate of the UK market. The reds can be very delicious, but also can be a little bit more challenging, a bit more austere. But yeah, great value for money. Really, wines with a lot of personality. They're very unique. Worth seeking out.
An emerging power, could it be?
I mean, value for money, the wines are great and they've got lots of personality, so the potential is there. If you want to try something different and you want to not spend too much money, it's a place to buy wine from.
Angus, you know, you talked there about not spending too much money. That's becoming more and more difficult if one is buying wine. We were talking about this just before we started recording. Wine's getting more expensive.
Well, we had really bad news, and we had a new duty increase from the government, and it's quite hefty. In some cases, about 40-45% on the current duty, and of course that attracts VAT on top. And they've done something really silly. So we've gone from 5 different bands of duty to 1 to 20 different bands. So a lot of red tape was going to cost a lot of money. And we get an increase in February 2025. Obviously, transport, it's difficult. So now is the time to explore different regions, different grapes. And obviously look for smaller producers where you get a lot more for your money than you would do from big producers, big brands, and smaller regions, some of which we'll be tasting today.
Well, we talked last time, I think it was at the Giro, before the Giro, talked to Greg about de-alcoholized wine. That's one way of getting around the increase in duties, but just drink less, a little bit less, just a drop less. We talked about this, didn't we?
Yeah.
Before we started recording, 125 milliliters instead of 175.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. You know, I mean, I maybe shouldn't say this, but I drink pretty much almost every day, but I have one nice glass of wine with dinner, you know, on the weekends, maybe two or three. But I open a nice bottle of wine and it lasts 2 days or 3 days. You know, just make sure I put the cork back, bottle back in the fridge, regardless of the color, take it out a little bit of time before drinking it. But yeah, I think drinking better and less, you just need to drink less. When you have a really nice glass of wine, sometimes one glass is enough.
Angus, let's get on to the Vuelta, shall we? Without too much further ado, now, the route is shaping up, the race is shaping up. It's a bit of a cracker. We've called it El Clásico, partly because of the football reference whisperer, because people get upset when we talk so much about football. However, El Clásico, of course, is the match that pits Barcelona against Real Madrid, two most famous football clubs in Spain, and the Vuelta is going this year from Barcelona to Madrid. Hence why we've called it El Clásico. But it is going to be a classic also because we've got Remco Evenepoel, Jonas Vingegaard, Juan Ayuso, Primoz Roglic, Geraint Thomas, cracking start list. From a wine lover's point of view, Angus, what about this canvas? When it was presented to you, knowing that you would have to create our case for this 2023 World Cup, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's always challenging because you want to offer people something they haven't had before. You know, you do not want to replicate, because the whole point of the case is the discovery of new landscapes and also new grapes and new wines. What I've done is swap things around. So 2 years ago, the layout was a little bit similar. So we were in Utiel and we had a really nice Bobal, in Valencia. And now we're going for a white from that area. And whites from the area are really rare. And the grape varieties are really rare. But we got a couple of cracking wines from there, which I'm sure that you're going to love and so are the listeners. And then in Bierzo a couple of years ago, we selected Amencia from Raúl Pérez, which is a flagship grape variety, which you're a massive fan of. It's great. Great mix and great wines. And we're going to go for a Godello this time. So we're having white wines from red wine regions. And then, of course, we've got a couple of clásicos. You know, we have finally a wine from Barcelona. We haven't had one for a while. We've got a beautiful cava. And then we got a fantastic Rioja del Duero that I sourced early on in February at Barcelona Wine Week. I pre-ordered the wine then and therefore this month.
You mentioned the wine from Barcelona or near Barcelona, and that is where we're starting. In fact, we are talking about 10 days from the start of the World Cup. We're going to kick off with the team time trial, but we're going to kick off. We're going to kick off with some fizz.
Cava.
Angus with a cava. Now, before we taste it, cava, there might be some confusion about what that is, what it has been in the past, because I think it was something that people became familiar with 10, 15 years ago. At one stage, it looked poised to become the alternative, the most popular alternative to champagne. And Prosecco, the Italians sort of, well, they snuck in.
I'm sorry,
Angus, but hey, what is cava?
So cava is a traditional method sparkling wine. Traditional method means it has two fermentations. So the wine has second fermentation in the bottle, which creates the magic. Creates the bubbles and that sort of lovely biscuity, pastry, brioche aromas that you get from the yeast process called autolysis. Now, two things you need to know about cava is that it's probably one of the very few traditional method sparkling wines in the world made with indigenous grape varieties, mostly. And the second thing is that it's fantastic value for money. You know, it used to be the best-selling sparkling wine in the UK 10 years ago, and it's obviously fallen off the cliff. Like many other classic...
Has it really?
It has. Like many other classic wine regions in the world, say Chianti, Suave, you know, it became popular Big boys go in, you know, but all the vineyards started producing high deals, low quality, and you started getting, you know, black frosted bottles in the supermarket and things like that, or stuff that didn't taste very good. So there's a new rejuvenation of the area, and people don't know about wine. I know that a few producers, very big, very good producers, left the Appellation Cava and created something called Corpinat about 5 years ago. So Cava had a serious look at this, and basically they put an emphasis on defining villages and also defining organic viticulture and long lease aging. So we're starting to see really, quality is really massively improved. It is the best value traditional method sparkling wine in the market.
Let's taste it.
Okay, so what do we got here? We've got Cava Reserva by a family called Sumaroca. Now, these guys have been wine growers for well over 150 years and they started making wine in 2008. Everything that they do is organic. They work organic with biodynamic principles and they make wine with extended lease aging. So this is mature for 24 months in bottle. Just to give you an example, a normal entry-level cover will be 9 months. So we're talking about wine that from the moment the grape gets harvested to it gets released to the market is 3 years.
Any red grapes in this? In Champagne, of course, there are red grapes used.
No, Cava is all about Charello, which is the king grape, or the quick, you know, the best grapes, Perellada and Macabeo. This wine has 7% Chardonnay. Chardonnay adds a little bit of texture and a little bit of mouthfeel, but never more than 7%. It's a component of the blend. But it's all about Charello, Macabeo, and Perellada, which are the traditional grape varieties. And it's lovely. It's biscuity because it's been 24...
Biscuity, but not too dry. Certainly not as dry as brut champagnes that people will be familiar with.
No, correct. But this is sun ripeness. We're in Spain. You know? We're in the Mediterranean. We're not in Atlantic. We're not inland. So this is one of the good things about Cava. If you're worried about sugar and calories, most of the Cava is a very low in sugar content or brut nature. In this case, this is a brut with 3 grams of residual sugar. So around this area, Costas del Segre, it's an area that has mostly reds, very Mediterranean, lots of the rum varietals, lots of Grenache, Mourvèdre, Carignan. As were all these great varieties, probable definitions took them into Catalonia and then traveled into France. The Catalonia, it's probably one of the oldest winemaking regions in Spain with about 3,000 years of history. The Phoenicians brought the grapes into the north, so near Girona.
Well, Angus, we are going to move on to our second wine, but before we do, you made some reference there to the ineffable P word, Prosecco. I think I brought it up first, and you're disgusted. Let's talk a minute about Prosecco versus Cava. Should one want to buy a bottle of Cava as an alternative, or maybe they would like to employ this Cava as an alternative to Prosecco, is it as versatile as Prosecco? Will you be absolutely cowering or bristling should someone use this in their Aperol spritz?
People need to buy what they like. Yeah, you just need to buy what they like. There is a difference in quality. There's a difference in winemaking and processes. Look, you can have two cars. They both can be red. They'll have four wheels and a steering wheel. But no, they're not both Ferrari. One can be a Fiat and the other one can be a Ferrari. Traditional method sparkling wines are more structured, have higher acidity. They're more versatile with food. And they're more interesting. But perhaps if you just want to drink a nice, easy, sparkling wine that's got a fair bit of residual sugar and it's hot, something simple, Prosecco is maybe the way to go.
For the avoidance of doubt, Prosecco is not traditional method?
No, it's been in the tank. So second fermentation in the tank usually lasts about 2 to 3 months. It's bottled and then released in the market. On average, most Proseccos will have 12 to 15 grams of residual sugar.
And what difference will people taste between a good Cava like this one and the off-the-shelf Prosecco?
So I'll say that Prosecco is a wine that bears towards sweetness. And it's got lots of sort of green characters, maybe a little bit of floral elements, but, you know, green apples. Traditional method sparkling wines, whether it's Franciacorta, Champagne, Cava, English sparkling wines, are much more savory. They're built around acidity, that sort of gisty, lovely gisty flavor, almonds, hazelnuts. They're just more complex wine. I mean, as far as I know, Prosecco in the 1970s was a wine very much like Moscato d'Asti, so a wine that was low in alcohol with high levels of residual sugar, so it stopped the fermentation by cooling the wine down, and you had a wine that had 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% of alcohol. Palo Residuo Chivano is very nice as an aperitif in summer. And they love sparkling wine in Italy. It's a country that they drink more sparkling wine. I think I never seen a country that drinks so much sparkling wine. But Prosecco was really made famous by Harry's Bar, you know, the famous cocktail, you know, with a peach puree.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the ways that he got his name. And also, too, I think the 2008 crisis played a massive role in the catapult of Prosecco in the UK market. There were two critics, Giles Corran and Agil, that really kind of wrote about it. None of them are really wine drinkers, but they say, you know, this is very cheap, but it's a good alternative. And he kind of sort of, through the recession, he kind of sort of took off. Until that moment, I think champagne was, you know, very much the number one quality sparkling wine sold in restaurants and bars, and that changed.
We've talked before as well about the sort of intangible factors in wine. I mean, wine's a fascinating industry to me as well, just because I think a lot of the normal principles of marketing business don't really apply or apply in different ways from other retail industries in particular. But things like, for example, the name of Prosecco, it's just exotic enough, but it also kind of trips off the tongue in a way that maybe another sparkling wine, name of another sparkling wine, may not. And who knows how much that contributed. No one will ever be able to ascertain that with any certainty. But it's always struck me that that could have been a factor as well.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Angus, next wine, please.
So, buckle up and get ready for the journey. So we're going to go and we're going to include our first natural wine ever in the case. But when I mean natural wine, I mean a wine that has nothing, absolutely nothing added to it. Not oak, not fining, not filtration, not additives, not sulfur. We've been working with the wines of Seyerles Forest for about 3 years. We love them. It's one of our zero sulfite wines in the shelf. And it's a really nice story. Roger, who is a teacher, he teaches history on secondary education in Spain, started teaching about 15 years ago. And 2 years later, he got assigned to work in Alicante. And he had to drive this 2.5 hour journey every day. And he kept driving past the vineyard with an old man at his dog. And he was blogging about wine, and he liked wine, but obviously he wasn't a winemaker or anything. And he just thought for himself, you know, if this old man can do it and looks happy with his dog, why can I not do it? So there you go. So about 12 years ago, he bought some land and he planted 3 hectares, which is tiny. And he planted loads of different grape varieties. There's even a clone of California Syrah in this wine. He's not trained, and I just love the purity of his wines. The wine, it's a little bit different. I'm sure it won't be for everybody. There's nothing not nice about the wine. You know, the wine is not fizzy. So what's really important about this wine needs to be decanted at least 15 minutes before drinking. And if you haven't got a decanter, that's fine. That's not a problem. Just pour yourself half a glass and 2 glasses and then let it sit there for 15 minutes. The other really interesting thing is that this wine changes all the time. So you can open it today, have a glass and put it in the fridge, and then have it tomorrow, and it will be totally different. You know, really important about this wine as well is the storage. So please, when you guys get your case of wine, put this wine somewhere cool, not in the kitchen. Make sure that it's a stable temperature. Put it in the fridge if you want. It's not a problem. But I hope you really like it. You know, it's a wine that's it's got loads of complexity. There's loads of flowers and, you know, sour red fruits on the nose, loads of Mediterranean herbs like wild sage, rosemary. Absolutely. The wine hasn't got any oak, but it's quite meaty on the palate. It's got some nice grippiness and lovely acidity. Definitely something for you can enjoy a lot with food. And yeah, I mean, I just really hope you guys enjoy this. This comes from Castellón. So we're in stage 5. We're stage Morella. It's really next door to Morella. It's a beautiful place. It's got some beautiful old caves. And it's the only natural wine producer in the whole region.
Wow. Is this something that's catching on in Spain particularly? I mean, it's sort of sweeping Europe in terms of, well, certainly the consumption in Northern Europe. And I think a lot of the time people don't necessarily know what natural wine is, what they're buying, but they sort of like the concept of it. They like the sound of it.
I think so. You know, I mean, a big driver of this was in the south of France, in the Roussillon, you know, and that, you know, if you go to Catalonia, you know, if you just go north of Castellón and you go into Montsant, it's probably about 35 national wine producers there.
Mm.
So it's massive in Catalonia. It's starting to show now in Andalusia, in Jerez. So definitely, definitely it's a movement that's it is picking up. We've got to be careful. I know we will never only stock natural wines. And when we stock natural wines, we taste them and we make sure that they are enjoyable. These guys, all they want to do is to make a wine that is as close to the soil and to the grape variety as they can possibly can. You know, and if you've got a wine that's got asphyxia or it's got off smells, then it's not a good one. Mm. So,
and when we talk about natural wines, Greg always talks about disease pressure and the relationship of climate and disease pressure. Basically, low humidity or lower humidity in some cases will lend itself more to the production of natural wine because it's less conducive for bad kind of bacteria and so on and so forth.
So in order to make natural wine, you need to be organic and biodynamic, generally speaking. And when you look after the soil, then your bunches are open, you know. You're not putting fertilizers. You're not pumping a lot of stuff on the ground. So basically the vines are not overproducing, you know. They're producing how they should do. So you have bunches that are a little bit less tight. You have a lot more. The wind can go through them. So you have a much healthier environment. It's like us humans, you know, if we start to think we take antibiotics and painkillers and vitamin supplements all the time, you know, our body's going to be, it's not going to be settled. And then we're likely to get sick easier, to have problems. So it's the same in the vineyard. So if you work biodynamically, you can, your vines are a bit stronger and in a much better position to fight disease. But yeah, the pressure is there and production can be sometimes half because of that.
Well, Angus, it's a fantastic start. Two wines down. We're still in the first week of the Huerta de España. I thought we'd pause at this point, Angus. In the past, or certainly I remember one podcast, I think before Agility Italia, which Greg briefly recapped his sort of wine origin story for us. We know that you are half Spanish, and we're going to say arbitrarily you're half Spanish, half Scottish.
Yes, Scottish.
You grew up in Tenerife, in the Canary Islands.
Yes.
Tenerife. Tell us why, how, when you became passionate about wine, please.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, there wasn't very much wine drinking in my family. And when I was there, really attracted to wine in my teens. But I'd always like, I love flavor and I love texture. I started my career as a chef. I just didn't like working as a chef because you don't talk to anyone. It's really antisocial. But breaking news, let me tell you a secret. Chefs have the worst eating habits and diets in the world. They love McDonald's at 1 o'clock in the morning. I just couldn't deal with that. And I just thought, if I'm going to be working as a chef making this food and not talking to people about it, then I said, not really interested. So what was the next thing? Flavor, you know, making things. So I'd spent 2-3 years as a mixologist, competed at national level mixologist. Yeah, so that's a guy who makes drinks behind the bar. So I did that for about 3 years, and then I came to the UK, and, you know, talking about late 90s, early 2000s, the cocktail scene was non-existent, really. You know, it hadn't really picked up. And I worked in some really nice places. I opened the Royal Opera House as a head bartender. About year 2000, but I kind of sort of got bored because it was all about gin and tonics and Becks, and you know. So an opportunity came to work in fine dining restaurants and in management, and I started that. I worked with a couple of really talented guys who nowadays are both master sommeliers, and that's when the bag of wine hit me. I tasted the wine; it totally blew me away.
What?
I can't say because it's from Grace Country. It's an Australian wine. No, I tasted a very special wine. It's called Hill of Grace, and it comes from Clare Valley. So it's a very old vine, 100% Syrah, sort of cooler climate, Australia. And it just totally blew me away. And then that was it, you know, 23 years later.
Have you done, are you a sommelier as well?
Or? So I done my WCT level 1, 2, 3, 4. I done the Core Master Sommelier level 1 and 2. So yeah, I worked for Richard Corrigan and Lindsay House, 1-star. I worked for Marco Pierre White, Terence Conrad. And then lastly, my last head sommelier role was with Heinz Beck at the Lanesborough about 10 years ago. So I managed wine lists from 300 bins to 2,500 bins. And I competed at national and international level. I'm still a sommelier. I still do a little bit of consultancy. I still occasionally go out and do some work in one or two stars, help guys out. It's a way of life, and you know, I'm always eager to learn more and visit more vineyards and taste more wine. You know, it's a wonderful wine. It's a never-ending world. You know, that's the beauty of it.
It is the beauty, but also the frustration as well, I find, with wine. I mean, other people think that maybe professional cycling is a complex and nuanced world, but nothing really pales in comparison to wine. You know, you could spend a lifetime just researching, finding out about, becoming passionate about soil types. You could also find that you could spend another lifetime just to learning every varietal that's drunk and planted everywhere else in the world. So it's a baffling world, and it's far too big to wrap one's arms around. However, let's try and wrap our arms around the rest of this Huerta Espana with our third wine, please, Angus.
So, we traveled a little bit further south from Castellón, and we're in Utiel. So Utiel, you know, really high altitude area, inland from the Levante, probably about an hour. It's a land that's famous for Bobal. We've got two different white wines in here. So Daniel, for this particular wine, we're going to work with the wines of a good friend of mine called Bruno Murciano. When I was just talking about being a sommelier and worked at the Lanesboro, Bruno Murciano was the wine director at the Ritz. And is a guy who is Utiel through and through. He's from a little village called Caudete de las Fuentes. And his mission in life is always to put Utiel and Bobal in the map. And he started his project in about 10 years ago, a little bit more than that. And as you know, this area is for red wine. So he had a vineyard, and about 200 vines out of 10,000 were white. So he started doing micro vinifications of these local grape varieties, and he liked what he did. So he bought a vineyard, grafted five indigenous grape varieties from the area, and released these wines about 5 years ago for the first time. So we got Pieles Doradas, which is a combination of Meserguera and Macabeo, which is really nice, very Mediterranean. It's got lots of lovely sage, some medlar fruit. You have this beautiful sort of Garrigue smells, you know, maybe a little bit of chamomile, a little bit of fennel. Really interesting. I think when you smell and taste these wines, you know you're in the Mediterranean, you know, either whether it's in France or in Spain, Mediterranean. Now, for the second wine, Las Blancas. The reason why we're doing two wines, you couldn't get, it's very small production. You know, those wines are made 7,000 and 9,000 bottles in total. So Las Blancas, which is the trade up for a mere £6 more, you can get Las Blancas. Las Blancas, it's an outstanding wine. It has equal parts of the five indigenous grape varieties that he planted in a single site. This vineyard is amazing. It's next to a river in the middle of a natural park, 1,000 meters above sea level, surrounded by a river and by a forest. There's nothing else around. Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting because it's five different grape varieties. The first grape variety ripens in the middle of August and the last one in the middle of October. So we're talking about 90 days. So what he does, Bruno, is picks all these grapes and puts them in a tank, keeps them at between 2 and 4 degrees to stop the fermentation. So the grapes are macerating for 90 days and he presses and ferments in large Burgundy oak barrels. They're about 600 liters. And it's a wine that's got beautiful complexity. It's got grapefruit, it's got beautiful white peach, it's got fennel, chamomile, yellow flowers.
More minerally than the first one.
Absolutely, yeah. You can, you know, this area that we're talking about, Castillo and Valencia, is all on a plateau of limestone. And limestone is so key for minerality, water retention, and viticulture. You know, same soils that you find in Champagne, in Chablis, in the Loire Valley.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily guess that it was from that part of the world. Usually, and this is maybe my lack of knowledge about white wine, particularly in that part of Spain, I would associate them with, well, low acidity, a little bit flabby, would they be?
Correct.
Typically?
Tired.
Yeah, not in this case at all.
No, there's loads of energy about those wines. You know, I recommend, so for both of these wines, Daniel, I recommend drinking them at 12 degrees temperature. I recommend decanting Las Blancas, the trade up, for at least 15, 20 minutes before you drink it.
White wine, that's not
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it opens up massively, drops the acidity, it becomes a lot more textured, you have a lot more of the fruit. If you like your wine really cold, some people do, I suggest you put the bottle of wine in the freezer half an hour before you decant it, and then put it in the decanter so you don't lose any temperature. But definitely decant the wine. I mean, they're great wines with food and without food. They have loads of personality. I personally prefer Las Blancas, more acidity, more minerality. Pérez Doradas is great. And I think, yeah, again, you know, a small producer, 6 hectares, you know, ex-sommelier, organic biodynamic principles, just a little bit of sulfur, but no manipulation, all wild yeast. And the barrels are old. They come from Burgundy. Yeah, really, I think, cracking stuff.
Excellent. I guess we're on to number four. Now, this takes us to stage. Where are we in the race? We are, I'm going to say we'll go with stage 11. This is a wine that could correspond to two different stages. So we're now after the Rese. Then for stage 11, we are sort of getting into Ribera del Duero territory. And that means that we can move on to wine number four.
Yes, so this is one of the other wines that I sourced at Barcelona Wine Week earlier on in February. Barcelona Wine Week is quite intense. I tasted 400 wines in 3 days. So it is a lot of fun. But yeah, I mean, that's how we roll in the wine world. You know, we spend our days off and holiday time visiting vineyards and tasting. And when we taste, we speed, you know, we don't drink because you've got to keep your palate fresh. And, you know, in most cases, you've got to drive from A to B. You can be, you know.
This is something that, I mean, I have very limited experience, but I have done tastings that involve 90 wines or so in a day, back in the day, many, many years ago, in Switzerland. But Angus, this is something that people maybe haven't done this, they don't appreciate how tiring it is, and also how, even with a spittoon at hand, it's quite difficult, isn't it, to remain lucid, shall we say?
Yeah, when I do it, I tend to do it in blocks, 2-3 hours, I tend to take a break, have a little sandwich, you know, a power bar, you know, get a bit of fresh air, and then go inside again, try to maybe do whites first, or reds, you know, try to have, you know, you have to have a plan, you can't taste it, you know, you have to have a plan, because otherwise it all gets a bit fussy, and I take notes, you know, taking notes takes time, you know, you got to think, because, you know, you got to look at the nuances, and you got to try to compare, you know, why is the one that you tasted better than the other one? What makes it that little bit better? What is it that you like? Tasting 100, it's a good effort. I tasted up to 200. I think 100 is a good effort. 150 might be a little bit too much. You have to take breaks. You got to focus, you know, and it's about, also too, I'm very democratic, you know, and I taste wine where I like the grape variety, I like the area or not. I need to understand what it's, the grape variety and the area, whether I like it or not. And for me, I think to be a good taster, you have to be impartial. You can't put your taste forward first, you know. Ribera del Duero, you know, what's not to like, you know, the Pomerol of Spain, you know, why is it full of power, full of black fruit, velvety wines. And this is another wine from a family of growers. They've been growing grapes since the late 1800s, and they decided to start making wine in 2015. So we're looking at the second vintage of this wine, 2016 Milenico Valdepila. When I tasted it in Barcelona Wine Week, I thought this is exactly what textbook Ribera del Duero is. You know, and I hope the listeners are going to enjoy as much. You know, it's a wine that has a lot of power, a lot of fruit, a lot of complexity, but it's got this beautiful velvety character, this dark chocolate, this black fruit, licorice, star anise, sweet vanilla. And then obviously, because it's 2016, so we're talking about a wine that's 7 years old, and you start getting hints of leather and also sort of forest floor on the palate. Great wine with a bit of meat.
Perfect wine for a sort of caveman like me with unsophisticated tastes, very dense, full of fruit, full of everything. It's quite extra, and I love it for that reason. However, it does make me think, you know, Greg and I, if there's been a theme over the last couple of years, it's been this sort of trend towards lighter wines, maybe more acidic, lighter reds.
Yeah.
And Ribera del Duero is, well, it's dense, it's big. As I said, it's extra. Is there a bit of a problem in Ribera del Duero? Is this something that people are talking about, that maybe the sort of trends it was taste of sort of veering away from this kind of wine slightly at the moment?
So look, I mean, these guys are 6 hectares. So they've got 20 hectares to sell the fruit from 14 away, and they keep all their own fruit. Organic biodynamic principles. 2016, slightly cooler year, it was quite wet. So the wine's got great acid. It's not a tiring wine. I mean, sometimes in Ribera del Duero, you tend to find there's quite a lot of oak on the wines. Mm. It's a region in Spain that you have to spend a bit of money. And it's all about balance. And, you know, Ribera, it's going through a process of young people. you know, working organic, biodynamically cutting out the oak. And what's important in here? Wild yeast, spontaneous fermentation. So not special yeast that work really hard to strike a number of flavors. Remember what I was talking before about disease pressure? So I was talking to Juan from Milenico last night in preparation for the podcast. And I said, you know, what about your disease pressure? You know, how are you working organic biodynamically? And he said to me, look, you know, if you cover your soil with, just some crop on top, so you got a little bit of grass, a bit of flowers, and you let the vines do their thing, you know, you have no problems because the branches are not tight, you know, you're not overworking the vine. So when you have a little bit of disease pressure, the vine usually fights it back. And that's the key. And I love this one. And I thought it was, I think it's a really good classic example and something with a bit of bottle age. Great value for money as well.
Well, Angus, we are creeping towards the conclusion of the we're that with stage, well, we're at stage 12, wine number 5, and we've got another red. We are close to Zaragoza, in fact, just south of there. I think the winery that makes this wine is located. We're going to be driving close to the front door. The race won't be going right past this winery, but tell us a little bit about the wine.
Well, we couldn't, Daniel, have a case without a Garnacha, you know, Garnacha in Spain, you know, this revolution of beautiful, light, vibrant, juicy wines. And Fernando is a very young winemaker, self-taught. He only started in the game, you know, 15 years ago. He's already got a Master of Wine achievement. You know, there's only about 400 of them in the world. The guy is just fantastic. He comes from, he was mechanic engineer, you know, but he got the wine bag. Bit him and this is a very good example of new wave Garnacha from Spain. It's bright, it's beautiful, highly aromatic with lots of hibiscus flowers, cranberry, cherry fruit, and a little bit of Mediterranean herbs. It's on the lighter side, so it's a wine that you want to drink with, you know, maybe some seared tuna, maybe beetroot salad. It's very, very versatile. And it comes to show the diversity in Spain. I think, you know, touch based on this before, you know, second most mountainous country in Europe, you know, some of the highest vineyards. Here we're looking at 700 meters altitude minimum. These 700 meters are the highest altitude vineyards in France. You know, we're looking at Jura, Sawa. And here, I mean, the Milenico that we had, the Ribera del Duero, we're looking at 1,000 meters. Bruno Murciano's wine, 1,000 meters. And that plays a big role, change temperature between day and night. You're making reference to the Rhone Valley.
I cross-examined you off mic about the difference between the Rhone wines and a wine like this. So the southern Rhone is very well known for Grenache, they call it in France, Garnacha in Spain. And wines that people will be familiar with, wines like Châteauneuf du Pape, Côte du Rhône, quite different from this.
Yes, so lower altitude, and they have these very specific soils. They have these massive pudding stones called galettes, and what these pudding stones do is they attract all the heat during the day, and then at nighttime reflect that heat back into the grapes and to the vines. So they, you know, it's hot all the time. Well, we're here, we're 700 meters above sea level. We're in Ribera del Duero. We're looking at a change in temperature of 10 degrees, sometimes 15 degrees between daytime and nighttime. So it slows the ripening process, you know, maintains acidity. One of the important things about this wine is that this is aged in concrete vats. So it's not oak. It's very pure, wild yeast ferment. But it's also have quite a lot of whole bunch. So whole bunch is when the winemakers decide not to destem the grapes and press it with the stems. So these stems give you a lot of freshness and also delays the fermentation and keeps the temperature low. So it means that you have a wine that's a lot more aromatic, more floral, more red fruits, vibrant, higher acidity. Why is it you want to be drinking all the time, particularly at lunchtime? It don't make you really tired.
Angus, this is a wine that's much more aligned with, I spoke about this trend towards lighter wines, lower alcohol, although 13% is exactly low alcohol, but a kind of wine you would chill probably, and as I say, yeah, much more sort of in line with the zeitgeist in red wines.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, definitely you can chill it. 12, 13, 14 degrees, you know, 5 degrees, maybe a little bit too cold. But yeah, it's light, it's juicy, it's delicious, it's easy, has low tannin. So if you've got a problem with red wine, tannin and headaches, you know, this is perfect wine. There's no oak, minimal sulfites, you know, it's naturally made, but it tastes very, very clean. You know, it's a great wine to enjoy all the time, and it's very, very, very versatile.
Angus, that brings us to our final wine, and we are going up, back up, northwest to the Edithor, one of my favourite regions I've discussed before, in on the edges of Galicia.
Yes.
And, well, unfortunately for me, we're not going to be having a red Edithor, but you promised me something equally exciting, and is a white Edithor. Tell us about it, please, Angus.
Yeah, so we're still in Castilla y León, you know.
It's Castilla y León.
It's Castilla y León, bordering, you know, almost bordering Galicia. Mm. You know, and a historic site, you know, the Romans came in here and had fantastic mining opportunities, and through the Romans being here, there's when the vines came into this region, there's a lot of gold in there. In fact, you can still get gold in the Minho River flow, the famous Portuguese river, if you like. So yeah, an area known for Mencia, one of your favorite grapes and wines, but they also have a grape variety called Godello, or Godello if you don't want to pronounce the double L. And it's a great grape variety. We should drink a lot more, and we need to be seeking this out. And this is from a winemaker called Gregory Perez. And if you remember, 2 years ago, we had Raul Perez Mencia. Raul Perez is one of the most emblematic winemakers in the world. This is his nephew. He's got a handful of vineyards, and we got a wine that's 90% Godello and 10% Doña Blanca. I'm sorry about this. It comes from granite soils. I know you don't want me to talk about soils, but granite produces wines that, you know, quite aromatic and quite mineral. And we got a wine that, you know, it's not too dissimilar to the mineral wines of northern France, you know, with beautiful honeysuckle floral notes, white peach, a little bit of lime leaf, that sort of citrus character. And then on the palate, a little bit more texture with more generous fruit, white peach, custard apple, almonds, and a really salty finish. It's an excellent seafood wine. It's a good alternative if you like things like Chablis or, you know, Sancerre, but it comes from Spain, and it's a great variety that 15 years ago nobody knew very much about it, and knew how to make wines, and now it's a great variety that's making great wines in Bierzo, in Ribera Sacra, and all around that area.
I'm very happy with the way you're endeavouring to sort of change people with this case, change people's image, or my image, at least, of white wine in Spain. Because as I said, when we were talking about the wine down by Valencia earlier, the white wine, I don't, minerality, the things you just mentioned, sort of something a bit like a Sancerre or a Chablis, that's not really what I generally think of when I think of Spanish white wine. A lot of people only think of, they'll think of Albariño in Galicia, which is a fantastic wine, and slightly sad that we haven't been able to get one in this year because the route doesn't go over there, right over to the coast in Galicia. Also, white Rioja, not much else. When people, the sort of lay customer, thinks of white wine in Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, White Rioja is perhaps the most famous example of white wine in Spain. But obviously, White Rioja is traditionally a little bit oxidative, aged for a long time. They're not really in vogue. When you get them, when you get good ones, the really good ones, I think White Rioja is an area where you have to spend a lot of money on white, and you get an amazing wine. If you spend little money, you get a wine that's a little bit underwhelming. And obviously, Verdejo. Verdejo is, you know, number one grape in Spain. But, you know, we had Palominos, you know, Mercegueras, Codellos, Doña Blancas. The white wine scene in Spain is flourishing at an incredible pace. And a lot of all vines are getting, and all varieties that we didn't know, through DNA research, are getting replanted. And vineyards that were abandoned are getting, you know, restarted again. So it's really an area to look for. But as always, Daniel, small producers, try to venture away from the supermarkets. Talk to your independents. When you go to the independents, make sure you have a budget in mind. You don't have to spend £30 on a bottle of wine. We got fantastic wines from Spain here for £15. And as with everything, you can't like everything. I don't like everything. You don't like everything. It's all about trying. But yeah, definitely it's something to be seeking out for. And of course, always buyers, but Spain is the most exciting wine country in Europe.
Angus, it's another aromatic sensation on the nose, I must say.
I love, you know, the one thing is that it's got citrus element, but it's got that sort of lime leaf. But then you have it on the palate, it's got some lovely textures with more generous fruit, you know, white peach if you ever had a custard apple before. And then some lovely saltiness at the end. I love that kind of sort of lovely saltiness that the wine has, that, you know, it begs you for more, you know, and you want to drink more and more. It's green Spain, you know, we are in green Spain, you know, and this is the beauty about all these mountain ranges and all these cerros and definitely, you know, this is north green Spain. It's not as cold as wet as Galicia, thank God, because it's quite difficult to make wine in Galicia, and that's why there's so much white grapes and not so many red grapes. But definitely, definitely green Spain. So, you know, very continental, very cold winters, very mild springs, warmer summers, but always that change of temperature between day and night. An area of that produces fantastic wines. Bierzo should be on everybody's radar for interesting wines. They've got good acid, they're not overly oaked, and they're really versatile with food or without food.
Angus, that concludes another fantastic selection from you this year. We haven't got Greg here to give us his... I don't want to call them hopeless predictions for the Vuelta a España. But Greg, I think he's definitely got one and a half eyes on the wine and half an eye on the cycling. Do you want to give us a prediction for the Giro d'Italia, for the Vuelta a España? There's no obligation.
My knowledge about cycling, it's not as great as it should be, but I think it's going to be a cracking race because you got beach mountain, you got Madrid, you got Barcelona. I kind of want to be there seeing it.
The Vuelta a España line, my colleague calls it the holiday grand tour. We you know, there's a lot of work involved, but it does feel there's a bit of a sort of end of term feeling about it. And Spain, what a great country to. I always say that the sort of romantic image that people have of a road trip around the United States, I always think is probably quite deceiving. It's probably a sort of Route 66 road trip in the United States probably end up being quite boring. If you want to do the ultimate road trip in Europe, and go and do it in Spain, because the roads are fantastic, there's not that much traffic, and you will happen upon mountain ranges, parts of the country that you didn't even know existed, and that they'll blow your mind.
Absolutely, and you got to remember, Spain is a nice country, it's nice and clean, people are friendly, it's cheap too, you can get a good plate of food anywhere, you have interesting wines by the glass in many places, and people are happy to see you. Unlike all the European countries, it's a little bit more difficult, you know, and yeah, I mean, you can drive from Andalusia to Madrid, which might seem like a pretty flat, boring road, and you see so many mountains, you know, the landscape, even in the motorway, the landscape is interesting. So yeah, I mean, absolutely. So many different languages, cultures, mountains, lakes, coastal areas. Yeah, definitely. I've done a twice a road trip through Spain and to Spain from the UK, and I can't recommend it enough.
Angus, it's been a pleasure. Ha sido un placer.
Muchas gracias, como siempre.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Creeb, and Lionel Burney.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.